thought tonight, I've got a message and I will get to it and I'll preach as much of it as I can before 8 o'clock. But I thought I would just talk a little bit about the Middle East because there are a lot of interesting things that are going on over there, and there's some things you're going to be hearing a lot about on the news. So I thought tonight it might be appropriate if I just talked about what's going on over there, and you'll be hearing quite a bit about it on the news. As you, I'm sure, heard on the news, the former Prime Minister of Lebanon, Harari, some time ago resigned because the Syrian troops, which at one time numbered 55,000, and are now down to 15,000, but the Syrian troops that came in when Israel withdrew as a part of an agreement with the United Nations agreed to withdraw in 1989. They didn't withdraw. They stayed. They've had a lot of pressure put on them to get out of Lebanon, but Syria considers Lebanon, they call it Greater Syria, so they've been dragging their feet for a long time. Well, finally the Prime Minister, former Prime Minister Harari, resigned because he said it was they were controlling Lebanon. Well, he resigned and he went out, went back, started another party, reinforced the party that elected him. They were going to have another election, and it was pretty sure that he was going to win it. So the Syrian military intelligence, from all appearances, had him assassinated with a car bomb. They killed him. Well, this immediately caused an uproar. And now Syria has promised that they will withdraw the troops, but they're still dragging their feet, and they haven't done it yet. So you'll see more and more pressure put on Syria by Europe, by the United States, to get their troops out of Lebanon. But I'll tell you what I think will happen. When Israel pulled out of Lebanon, Iran got a bunch of Shiites down in the southern part of Lebanon, and they formed them together into what they called Hezbollah, which is Arabic for the Party of God. And they trained them into a very elite terror group. And they grew so much in size that they are not just a terrorist group anymore. They're a terrorist army. They control a large segment of southern Lebanon. So immediately after the assassination, the blowing up of Prime Minister Harari in Lebanon, all of a sudden these Shiite people from the army started moving north in Syria. And I would imagine by the time Syria does pull out, Hezbollah will be pretty much in control of all of Lebanon. And that way Syria can maintain control because Hezbollah is supported by Syria and Iran. Now, I have taught for 30 years that the 10 nations that would attack Israel would not be European nations, but they would be Islamic nations. Yesterday, the announcement came out that once Israel is disengaged and the Palestinians have a peace with the Israelis, 10, it's interesting, 10 Arab nations said they would put their embassies inside Israel and they would establish diplomatic relations with them. I thought the number 10 was interesting because right now none of them had any ambassadors in Israel until Egypt sent theirs back and Jordan sent theirs back. And now 10 more are saying as soon as the peace thing is completed, they will for the first time establish diplomatic relationships with Israel. So it's looking to me like the false peace is going to come in. We call it something different from what is commonly used in civilian jargon, but I'm going to use the term that's used in the civilian jargon. It's called bottom line. In synoptic analysis, what you do is you figure out all the possibilities, and then after you've got them all weighed, you get down to what's the bottom line. Sometimes there is no bottom line. Sometimes you just honestly don't know what's going to happen. But I'm going to talk to you about something that's very important, because I have taught for 30 years that Iraq would be one of the 10 toes of Daniel's stature. And when we went and invaded, a lot of people said, see, they're not going to be one of the 10 toes. I assure you they will be. Now, for the next few months, you're going to be hearing about a wild shuffling of political parties in Iraq. They have a parliament of 250. The Shiites got 60 of the seats, not a majority. Kurds got 25 of the seats, and another group of Shiites got 25% under the current Prime Minister Alawi. Now, the bottom line on all this transpiring in the election is this. After it's all over, you're either going to have a secular Shiite, which means a man who doesn't want the government run by religious leaders, which would be Alawi, and I don't think he'll win, or you'll have a religious prime minister who will be a Shiite in control of the government. There's going to be a lot of inter-party negotiations. Now, the one thing you don't want to see in Iraq is a religious Shiite government, because a Shiite government is run by preachers. Now, they call us preachers. They call me a preacher. They call everybody that has anything to do with leading a church preacher. In the Islamic faith, they call them clerics. Now, I'm a preacher, but I don't want preachers running this country. I have always believed that a preacher is supposed to preach the gospel and stay out of politics. And so I don't think the country should be run by preachers. And these clerics, as they're called, are absolute religious fanatics. They don't believe the women should be allowed to vote. They believe they should wear these garbs. They believe they should be stoned to death for any kind of a sin, particularly adultery. And it's a horrifying type of government. It's government run by Shiite fanatics. Now, the party that run the most votes has a man named Dr. Jari with him. He's the leader. If he gets in as prime minister, and I think he will, then you're going to have a situation in Iraq where they are pro-Iranian, where they do not like the United States any more than they do now, really. Everybody keeps talking about how they like us. A few do. But that'll all quickly change. Now, when Saddam Hussein was the president of Iraq, he led that country with the Sunnis, which are a minority group. But he was so brutal, and the Sunnis were so hateful, that they just butchered the Shiites, the Kurds, and everybody else, and they ran the government by sheer control of military force. And there were more than 60% of the population were Shiite in the southern part of Iraq. Well, now Saddam Hussein is gone. Saddam Hussein led a war against Iran, and they killed millions of Iranians, and there was bitter hatred between Iraq and Iran. But that's changing. Now, I will guarantee you this, bottom line. Regardless of what candidate is elected, he will be a Shiite Muslim. And once that happens, and he gets in as prime minister, our troops are coming home. And that's good news, because I have never believed that we should leave our troops over there. I was in favor of going in and getting Saddam Hussein and knocking him out and getting rid of him. We've done that. Now pull out of there and let the Kurds and the Sunnis and the Shiites fight it out. I want it destabilized. The worst thing we could possibly have is a stable government in Iraq that despises us and despises Israel. And that's just exactly what we're going to get. So it may not take quite as long to get it if you get a secular Shiite president, which is possible. But if you get the one who's supposed to win, you're going to get a religious Shiite government, and the quicker we get out of there, the better. Now, I hope that President Bush will start to pull our troops out of there in July. And I hope the sooner we get out of there, the better. We're not doing one bit of good over there. Now, people say to me, well, Brother Michael Murray, just look at the democracy. I'm telling you from personal experience and having worked among the Arab nations, there is no way, and I have to answer what I'm saying at the judgment seat of Christ, there is no way under heaven you will ever build a democratic government in the Middle East. It can't be done, period. So the quicker we get out of there, the better. You want a democratic government in the Middle East? Well, you're going to have one. It's going to happen when Jesus Christ comes back. And everybody gets to vote. But everybody's going to vote his way. And everybody's going to like it. But until that happens, the situation in the Middle East is going to go downhill. We're going to get a false peace. It's going to come one of two ways. Either Iran and Syria will wake up and call off Hezbollah, call off Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and the Al-Aqsa Mortar Brigade and say, cool it, until, for a little while. And I think they're on the verge of doing this, and I hope they do. If that happens, we will have a negotiated peace. The Palestinians will be behind the walls. The wall will be completed no matter what. And by 2006, Israel will believe it has, finally, a peace with safety based on that wall. That's what I'm hoping will happen. But it's going to happen, even if I'm wrong about the peace being negotiated. If those Palestinian terror groups, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, Al-Aqsa Mortar Brigade, if they blow up an Israeli cafe, if they blow up an Israeli bus, if they pull some big shenanigan where it kills a bunch of Israeli civilians, the IDF, the IAF, and the PDQ, FOB, COD, and IOU are going to go in and invade Gaza. It's not going to be one of these tactical strikes where they just pinpoint targets by the Israeli Air Force and the Israeli Defense Force. It's not going to be like that last one. It's not going to be in where they go in and try to distinguish between the terrorists, the good guys, and the bad guys. They're going to go in, and they're going to invade the Gaza Strip, and they will invade the West Bank. And Israel will go in there, and they will kill an awful lot of innocent people. But they're going to get the terrorists. A lot of innocent people are going to die, but they're going to get the terrorists. And once they go in there and do that, they're going to put the Palestinians behind that wall and say, okay, now you got your territory. But the Palestinians are going to get about 30 or 40% less if Israel has to use force. And this next time, it's going to be war. It's not going to be Operation Defensive Shield. It's going to be a war. And Israel is going to go in there, and they are going to kill a lot of people. And they'll bring in a force peace. So the bottom line is this. You're going to have a false peace in Israel. It may be forced. It may be negotiated. But it's coming. And the bottom line in Iraq is, you're going to end up with a government over there that does not like the United States, despises Israel, and they are going to be one of the nations that comes against Israel. And this is going to be happening, I think, on a pretty fast clip over the next couple of years. So look for that. I think it's on schedule, and I think things are going pretty good toward it. Now, here is Iran. You see how big it is? Huge. Here is Iraq. Iran is having direct influence now in Iraq. And 60% of the vote went, 59%, went to the Shiites, who are Islamics, who are Iranians, who are in the southern part of Lebanon. So you're going to see probably an Islamic Republic in here, just like Iran. And they're going to be more opposed to Israel and to us than they ever were under Saddam Hussein. And this whole area is building up, and pretty soon you're going to have an attack against Israel. I think it'll probably occur in 2007. Maybe not. But that's what I think. So this is what I'm putting out tomorrow on the website. Not on the website, but I'm putting it out on email. As I indicated in archive proxy update number 211B, the only question that will be settled in the voting for a new Iraqi parliament is this. Will we have a new Iraqi government that has a prime minister who is a secular Shiite or a religious Shiite? The former, certainly, being the most desirable of two bad choices. When Saddam Hussein, a Sunni, was able to brutally subdue, kill, or imprison a much larger Shiite majority by the sheer brute force of a much smaller minority of Sunnis in the central sections of Iraq, his forces were in absolute control of the vast southern Shiite population, and Iran was treated as an enemy of Iraq. In fact, the war between the two, in which we aided Iraq militarily, caused the slaughter of millions of Iranians, and the two countries despised each other. The tide has made a 180-degree turn, and Iraq is either going to be a close bosom buddy or just friendly to Iran. It depends on which of the two Shiite candidates is elected prime minister. The political battles that are sure to take place over the next few months may well expose the deep fault lines that have been covered over since the fall of Saddam Hussein. Now, I'm not a Johnny-come-lately to all this. I trained Sunnis in the National Security Agency. I trained Shiites. I trained all sorts of different sects within the Islamic faith. And I'm telling you the differences between these sects is astronomical, and they hate each other. These deep fault lines are both sectarian and religious. Ask sometime, just casually, if you're so inclined, when this young man that Vicky brings here, he is a Sunni Muslim from Azerbaijan. Ask him, say, are you Shiite? And watch the reaction you get. He'll say, no, I'm not a Sunni. He is a Sunni. There's a tremendous difference, and they don't like each other. And that's what Saddam Hussein was. These deep fault lines are both sectarian and religious, and a struggle will be apparent between the parties as to what type of state they want to create. Now, when you're watching the news, you'll be able to pick all this out. The two choices are concerning Iraq, what it's going to become. Should it be religiously, centrally led, or governed by a federal system? It should be governed by a federal system, with all parties being given equal opportunity. But if this fellow gets elected, that I think is going to get elected, it's going to be religiously, centrally led. And two, should it be allied to Iran or anchored to ties to the West? With either one of them, it's going to end up anchored, allied with Iran. And it's just going to take longer if the man who I think is going to win loses. The forerunner is Dr. Jafari. And if he is elected, the government is more likely to be religiously, centrally led and allied strongly with Iran. If Dr. Alari were to be elected, the government would likely begin as one. The government would likely begin as one governed by a federal system, which is quite desirable, and would maintain ties with the West. However, I strongly suspect, more than that, it will. I strongly suspect it would be overthrown by outside influence from Iran and quickly replaced by a pro-Iranian government. The quicker we get out of Iraq and let the fur fly, as the Sunnis, Shiites, and Kurds slug it out for supremacy, the better off we will be. Because in the end, whatever is left of Iraq will not be pro-American or pro-Israeli. And it will be on their hit list, we, the United States, will be on their hit list, along with Israel, when the 10 toes of Daniel's stature begin to wiggle towards Israel. That's what this is talking about here. Daniel 2:42-44. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. That's why you can't have a kingdom, because you've got so many different sects of Islamics that don't get along with each other, so many different groupings within the Islamic faith, They just can't seem to stick together for very long. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves together with the seed of men. You know what? The Jews have maintained somewhat of ancestral purity. The Jews are the descendants, basically, of the man Jacob, whom God renamed Israel. And they have kept close within their faith. Very few have ever married out of it. But Abraham had two sons. He had Isaac, and he had Ishmael. And the Arabs are the descendants of Ishmael. And then after Sarah died, Abram married another woman called Keturah. And Keturah gave Abraham six sons. And Lot had two illegitimate sons, Moab and Ammon. So let me tell you what the Arabs are. They are a mingled group where the seeds were mingled of the six sons of Keturah, Abraham their father, and Ishmael, and the two illegitimate sons of Moab and Ammon. They are a mixed race. They've intermingled with the seed of men, and they shall not cleave one to another. They'll cleave together long enough to drive Israel into the Negev, even as iron is not mixed with clay. In the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom. The Lord Jesus Christ will return at the end of the tribulation period. He will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all the kingdoms that were before it. The kingdoms of the Egyptians, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Medo-Persians, the Grecian or Alexandrian Macedonian Empire, and the Roman Empire, and the Antichrist Empire. And here's these same kings again. Revelation 19:21. And I saw the beast, the Antichrist, the kings of the earth, and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse and against his army. The beast was taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast and them that worshipped his image. These both were cast alive into a lake of fire burning with brimstone, and the remnant were slain with the sword of him that sat upon the horse. This is the Lord Jesus Christ, who returns to end all this at the battle of Armageddon, which sword proceeded out of his mouth, and all the fowls were filled with their flesh. So I thought tonight I would at least mention that, because there are a lot of interesting things going on in the Middle East, and I think the more we know about it, the better off we are. What we're moving into, and we're not in it yet, but we're close, is what's known as the time of Jacob's trouble. Now, the time of Jacob's trouble begins when Israel is attacked from the north. It occurs at the same time that this great earthquake occurs in the book of Revelation. In Revelation 6 and 12, the first earthquake in the book of Revelation, and there was a great earthquake, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. That's when Jacob's trouble starts. It lasts for 3.5 prophetic years, sometimes called 1,260 days, sometimes called 42 months, sometimes in the Bible called times, times, and half a times. We're close to that. Now, I've told you repeatedly, and I'll say it again because I want to be emphatic about it. I think this is going to occur. It was going to start in 2007. That's an estimation on my part. It's an approximation. It's something I believe. It's not something I know. But I think that's when this great earthquake is likely to occur in the Jordan Valley. That's when the Antichrist is likely to launch his attack from the north. That's likely when the last 3.5 years of the tribulation period began. Now, in Jeremiah 30:15, the Lord tells the nation of Israel he is bringing the time of Jacob's trouble on them because they deserve it. We're going to look at that in a moment. In Jeremiah 30:16, the Lord tells the nation of Israel of the trouble he intends to bring on her enemies when he saves her out of the trouble he accomplished on her. Israel had been living in the relatively peaceful time of the Roman Empire. I don't know if you remember when you were in high school and they talked to you about the Roman Empire, and they call it the Pax Romania, meaning a peace of 1,000 years. The Romans said they were going to bring in an empire that would have a peace of 1,000 years. Didn't quite make it, but it was a peaceful time. Now, it wasn't peaceful when they went out and conquered all these people, but once they got them conquered, all these nations settled down. The Romans set up a governmental structure, And it was a relatively peaceful time when Jesus was born. It's true that Israel was under the Roman yoke, but they had it pretty good. They were pretty prosperous under it. It would have been described as a time of the green tree. So in Jesus' day, as far as the materialistic value of the nation of Israel, as far as their prosperity was concerned, as far as food, clothing, and shelter and good times, they had them. It would have been called a green tree. It would have been described as the time of the green tree associated with prosperity, as opposed to a dry tree, which is associated with famine. Israel rejected her King Messiah in the time of a green tree. And because of this rejection, they were going to enter a time of the dry tree some 40 years later. Some 40 years later, Israel dried up as a nation. That's why Christ cursed the fig tree outside the temple, was crucified, and 40 years later, their green tree days ended, and they were overrun by Titus and destroyed as a people and a nation. From the time that the Temple of Herod was destroyed until June of 1967, they were in the period of the dry tree. They've been in it ever since. In 1967, with Old Jerusalem restored to them, they have again entered a green tree period, which I believe is likely to abruptly end and be followed by the tribulation period. All this has and will be done unto them by the God whose Son they rejected and crucified. Now remember in Jeremiah 30:15, the Lord tells the nation of Israel he is bringing the time of Jacob's trouble on them because they deserve it. Jeremiah wrote this book. He was contemporary with Ezekiel and Daniel. They wrote in about 600 B.C. Now notice what Jeremiah is telling Israel is going to happen to them. He told them about Jacob's trouble, and then in verse 15, why criest thou for thine affliction? He says, what are you crying about? He's talking about Israel's attitude for the last 2,000 years. I don't know how many times I have read articles by different Jewish writers, and they have expressed this particular viewpoint. They say, why is God doing this to us? Why has God allowed this to happen? Why were 6 million of us killed in the Holocaust? How come our God has forsaken us? Why are we so afflicted? Why are we so hated? Well, Jeremiah tells them why this time of Jacob's trouble is coming on him. He said, why criest thou for thine affliction? Thy sorrow is incurable for the multitude of thine iniquity. He said, you got so sinful it was pathetic. And then you committed the greatest sin of all. You crucified the one who was sent to redeem you. Why criest thou for thine affliction? Thy sorrow is incurable for the multitude of thine iniquities, because thy sins were increased. I have done these things unto thee. He said, that's why I've done it. And he's telling them in advance what he's going to do to Israel, because he knows they're going to reject his son. Nevertheless, he sent his son. In Matthew 23:29-38, Jesus describes the hypocritical religious veneer the Jews are faking on the outside while being filled with inner spiritual adultery. Now, if you want to know the difference between religion, you can pick out somebody who may wear fine clothes, long flowing robes, a white collar, and say, the Lord be with thee. The Lord look upon thee to make his face smile upon thee. And be able to have a great oratory ability to speak smoothly and to say words of comfort to you. And to sound like he came directly down out of heaven on a pile of King James Bibles. But in the inside, he's just like these scribes and Pharisees. And there's a bunch of them around today. In Matthew 23:29-38, Jesus describes the hypocritical religious veneer the Jews are faking on the outside while being filled with inner spiritual adultery. Spiritual adultery. Not being of God, but claiming to be of God. He tells them the affliction from which they will soon cry out to God. Jeremiah told them, he said, don't cry out to me for your affliction. He said, here's why you're going to be afflicted. Asking what is happening is well deserved, and that he's the one orchestrating it. The Lord has allowed Israel to be the most persecuted, prosecuted, hated, despised, butchered, maligned people on the surface of this earth, because they willfully and purposely delivered their Messiah to a Gentile to be crucified, because they could not crucify him according to their own law, But they delivered him to Pilate because Pilate could. Matthew 23:29-38. Now here's what he's talking about, and this is what Jeremiah is talking about, the religious condition of Israel, spiritual adultery. Woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, because ye build the tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous. And say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Wherefore be ye witnesses unto yourself, that ye are the children of them which kill the prophets. Fill ye up then the measure of your fathers. Ye serpents, ye generation of vipers, how can ye escape the damnation of hell? They were the most religious people on the earth, and outwardly they appeared to be representatives of God, but they were full of dead men's bones. They were hypocrites. Wherefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them ye shall kill and crucify. And they did. And some of them shall ye scourge in your synagogues and persecute them from city to city. And they did. That upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon this earth, from the blood of righteous Abel unto the blood of Zacharias, the son of Barachas, whom ye slew between the temple and the altar. Verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation. And look how he closes it. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as the hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. Okay, that's your green tree. That's when Israel was in a pretty good time of prosperity. They were filled with spiritual adultery. They were hypocrites. They weren't worshiping God. They were worshiping their own form of religion. Everything about them was phony. It was all outward veneer. But prosperity, they had it. Material goods, they had them. The nation was blessed with prosperity. They did well under the Roman yoke. And they had a good system of government, and people were treated fairly. So they had it made. They had a green tree. Jesus said, that's all going to change. As he was going to the cross in Luke 23:27-31, I want you to notice what he told these women. Luke 23:27-31. There followed him a great company of people and of women, which also bewailed and lamented him. But Jesus, turning to them, said, daughters of Jerusalem, weep not for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. He said, for behold, the days are coming in which they shall say, blessed are the barren, those that don't have any children, and the wombs that never gave suck, and the pap that never gave suck. Then shall they begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. For if they do these things in a green tree, he said, if you're rejecting me as your Messiah, in all this midst of spiritual adultery, and your temple is a den of thieves, he said, if you do this now, what shall be done in the dry, in the day of the dry tree? And the day of the dry tree came on them in 1970. And it was on them continuously until June of 1967, when Moshe Da'an and the Israeli troops took back the old temple mount. Now, we started off back here in Jeremiah 30. And Jeremiah 30, 15, the Lord tells the nation of Israel, he is bringing the time of Jacob's trouble on them because they deserve it. That's all we've talked about so far. Now we're going to look at Jeremiah 30, 16. The Lord tells the nation of Israel the trouble he intends to bring on her enemies when he saves her out of the trouble he accomplished on her. But she shall be saved out of it. First part of Jeremiah 37. The last of that day is great, none is like at the time of Jacob's trouble. Okay, that's all we've talked about so far. Last part, but he shall be saved out of it. Okay? We talked about the bad stuff in Jeremiah 30, 15. Now let's talk about the good stuff. This is what's going to happen to all those people that mistreated Israel. In Jeremiah 30, 16, the Lord tells the nation of Israel the trouble he intends to bring on her enemies when he saves her out of the trouble he accomplished on her. And he is going to zap the enemies of Israel. And here's where he talks about what he's going to do to the Antichrist army. They're going to be devoured. The beast and the false prophet are going to be thrown into a lake of fire, and the Antichrist army is going to be decimated. Jeremiah 30, 16. Therefore, all they that devour thee shall be devoured, and all thine adversaries, every one of them shall go into captivity. He said, you're going to become the ones who are the captors, and they're going to be the ones that are captured. And they that spoil thee shall be a spoil. He said, those that took your goods, he said, you're going to take theirs. And all that prey upon thee will I give for a prey. He said, those that hunted you down like birds to track them and take them as a prey. He said, you're going to hunt them down and take them also. God, after telling them why he has done this to them, in verse 16, tells them what he is going to do to the nations that afflicted Israel. And Isaiah, who wrote in 700 B.C., Isaiah describes what God has in mind to do, and when he writes in Isaiah 66, 16 through 20, Jeremiah tells what he's going to do to the enemies of Israel, and look at what Isaiah does. He tells you what he's going to do to the enemies. Isaiah 66, 15 through 20. For behold, the Lord will come with fire, and his chariots like a whirlwind, to render his anger with fire and his rebuke with flames of fire. For by fire and by sword will the Lord plead with all flesh, and the slain of the Lord shall be many. That's why I'm not worried about the tribulation period. That's why I'm not concerned about, am I going to die? Am I going to make it through it? Is everything going to be fine? I believe God's going to watch out for us. And I think that God wants us to have faith that he will. For by fire and by his sword will the Lord plead with all flesh, and the slain of the Lord shall be many. They that sanctify themselves and purify themselves in the gardens behind one tree in the midst, eating swine's flesh. You see, these are Gentiles. And he's telling you what Gentiles do. Eating swine's flesh and the abomination, which is a small mouse, and the mouse shall be consumed together, saith the Lord. For I know their works and their thoughts. It shall come, and I will gather all nations and tongues. This is all the Gentile nations of the world, and they shall come and see my glory. He said, I'm going to come against them like a whirlwind. He said, I'm going to kill most of them. And those that survive, he says, they're going to come and see my glory after I have defeated them and after you are established as a nation. And I will set up a sign among them. The sign is Jesus Christ himself returned as Messiah. And I will send those that escape out of them into the nations. All those that were at the battle when Israel, God returned Jesus Christ and defeated them. According to Ezekiel 39 and 2, only 1/6 will survive. And the 1/6 are going to go back out of there to all their home Gentile countries. And I will send those that escape of them into the nations, to Tarshish, Pul, and Lud, and draw the bow, to Tubal, and Javan, to the isles afar off, that have not heard my fame, neither have seen my glory, and they shall declare my glory among the Gentiles. And they shall bring all your brethren for an offering unto the Lord out of all nations upon horses. There won't be much left in the way of transportation when all this happens. They'll get them back to the west best way they can. And in chariots and in litters and upon mules and upon swift beasts to my holy mountain Jerusalem, saith the Lord, as the children of Israel bring an offering and a clean vessel into the house of the Lord, and I will also take of them for priests and for Levites, saith the Lord. I'm going to take up here, perhaps next Wednesday night or maybe some future time, but I'll tell you, I'm an analyst. I spent a large part of my life as an analyst. An analyst is supposed to be honest with himself, with God, and with people. If an analyst is an unbeliever, he's supposed to at least be honest with himself and with people, regardless of whether he believes in God. I have never, in my entire career as an analyst, seen anything like this Bible. Every single thing that's in it lines up perfectly with everything else. It's not because I'm smart. It's because it just does. And all those prophets, writing at all those different times, never knowing one another, have put together a document by the leadership of God's Spirit that has no error and no flaw in it. Now, that's a tremendous help to me, because sometimes I wonder, I think, am I misleading people? Am I misdirecting people? Have I worked out my own agenda on this? I have to live with myself and with God. And I'm telling you, that's the most amazing book I've ever seen in my life. And I don't have any hesitation or reservation in telling you that, yeah, I may not have some of it right. I realize that, because in the past I didn't have some of it right. But I've been working on this a long time, and I have never seen anything quite like it. And as I've said so many times, what we need to do is to start making ourselves ready for His coming. That's the main reason I started preaching. Well, the Lord led me that way. I wasn't inclined to do it, but that's the main reason on Sunday morning I started preaching about, and now abideth hope, faith, and love, and the greatest of these is love. It's time to have some spiritual growth in my life. It's time to have some spiritual growth in each one of our lives. And we're in the right place. We're in the Lord's church. And we need to start trying to, I guess for want of a better expression, we need to clean up our act. We need to clean up our attitude toward the Lord, toward His church. And we need to start doing what we do out of our love for the Lord and for no other reason. And we need to do it unbegrudgingly, just because He is our Lord and He is our God, and because we love Him. And it is exactly 30 seconds. So y'all are going to get out early.